I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, I'm Gary Kemp.
And I'm Guy Pratt, and we are getting ready for the next Rock on Tours Live.
Yep. Join us at the iconic Battersea Power Station in London for a special screening of Quadrophenia, followed by a recording of the podcast, where our guests will be director Frank Rodham and the star Phil Daniels.
Unbelievably exciting, genuinely. It's happening on the evening of February the 22nd. Sign up now at rockontours.com to get exclusive pre-sale access to tickets before they go on general sale.
A celebration of a British classic, Quadrophenia. See the film and join us for a special episode of Rock on Tours. All the details on the early access tickets are at rockontours.com. So get your best mod gear ready.
See you then. Hello, Gary.
Hello, Guy. I bought a flute.
Yes, you said. Why? What on earth would possess you to do such a thing?
Do you know, my son plays saxophone, and he had to upgrade to a larger size. And I've had my eye on a flute for a long time. I just thought it would be meditative. And, you know, it's apparently proven that when you get to a certain age, it's really good to learn a new musical instrument. Good for the brain. And so
that's true.
You know, I'm trying to sort of work on that bit, really. And I just thought, you know, this is a good thing, a good sound. You know, that's what I like about the flute. I've always liked it. You know, Peter Gabriel, Ian Anderson, you know.
Yeah, well, also, it's great. It means the codpiece I've got you for Christmas will be just the thing now. But yeah. Actually, funny enough, I just look, because I've actually got a Chinese wood flute.
Have you?
And the reason I bought that was because I went to the Shanghai Music Fair about 4 or 5 years ago, which is a giant NAM type thing, you know, with all the all the instrument equipment manufacturers show off their stuff. And this thing was huge. It was like 8 Olympias big. It was massive. Right.
And of Apocalypse course, NAM.
And all those music fairs are basically just kids in black t-shirts shredding. Yeah. And blokes slapping basses. It's, you know, if aliens arrived on Earth during one of those music fairs, they would think that all a guitar can do is shred and all a bass can do is slap.
None of whom are in bands. I mean, it's all rigs of dad, right?
No, exactly. And they're all into that new metal. It's all super chops. I mean, you know, it's some technically amazing stuff. I'm sorry, it sounds like someone digging up the road to me, but a lot of it. And there was this one pavilion in the middle, which was traditional Chinese instruments. And you go in and there'd just be these sort of harps and flutes playing, and it was just so heavenly and restful.
You had a gong massage.
That's why I have a wood flute.
What do they call those gong massages?
A gong bath.
Gong bath, yes.
Yeah, I didn't have time. I had a gong shower.
You know, that's why flutes are woodwind, because they used to be made of wood. Because, you know, they're not played with a reed, are they? And they're made out of metal. I mean, so the hardest thing, I think, the way I'm struggling on the flute is standing on one leg. Obviously, but I determined that my Jethro Tull tribute band will play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star, and then it's going to be great.
What's the and is there a sort of flute equivalent of Burt Whedon's Play in a Day?
Yeah. Anyway, we've bored our listeners enough with my flute. I'll let you know how it's getting on.
Have you got a flute? Have you got a flute story? Tell us your favourite flute.
We've got someone on today that is, I'm sure you could play the flute, because, I mean, 10cc were the most multi-instrumentalist band ever.
Yeah. They were, in fact, every one of them could have been a band.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Without leading anyone else.
Yeah, well, in fact, they were. I mean, they almost had their two bands sort of come together. I mean, there were two different groups of songwriters, wasn't there? Lowell Cream and Kevin Godley and Eric Stewart and Graham Gordman, who's with us today. But Graham's history goes back a lot further than 10cc, doesn't it, Guy?
It does. Well, yeah, he was in all sorts of very cool named bands and wrote one of the most important songs. So I don't know about you, Gary, because when I first sort of got into music and you had to do your history, which back then only went back about 10 years, but it was like all roads lead to the Yardbirds.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
That was the thing. Or, you know, and For Your Love was that what became this iconic. It was, you know, of course it was before the internet. It was ages before I heard it. But this became this absolutely iconic fixed thing, wasn't it? For Your Love by the Yardbirds.
Yeah, written by Graham
he
Gorman.
Wrote it. He
written
wrote
by
it.
Graham Gorman. Yeah. You know, I mean, the Yardbirds take up quite a few pages, don't they, in Pete Frame's rock family tree.
Yes, absolutely.
Obviously, so Graham had, I think on For Your Love, Eric Clapton.
Three hits. Yeah.
Eric Clapton played guitar.
That's right.
And on the second one, Heartful of Soul, that he wrote, he's only 18 or 17 when he's writing this.
Yeah.
Heartful of Soul, he had Jeff Beck playing on. You know, then he wrote for the Hollies. He wrote Bus Stop for the Hollies.
And then so is Pagey on the last one. There's the Evil Heart.
Yeah, maybe. I think that's still Jeff Beck, I think. But we'll ask him. We can ask Graham himself.
We can ask
him. You know, lots to talk about, you know, as far as, you know.
And then all the way through, then it's got, and then after 10, I mean, it's like he'll probably be writing a song while we're talking to him. He clearly just never stops.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
All the way through to McFly. And then this amazing partnership with Andrew Gold,
yeah.
Who, you know.
And recently he's been playing with Ringo Starr.
Yeah.
Never stops, does it, for this guy? I think he's 77 and he just keeps, you know, it's more power to him. Let's get him on.
Welcome to the Rock on Tours.
Okay, guys, I'm ready.
But it's a big tune for sure. I actually wrote that originally for Tina Turner.
Of course, I had gone and found Joni Mitchell down in Florida and brought her back.
I've listened to a few of them and they've been really good, man. I'm sitting in the back of the car coming into London. They're brilliant.
That caused a big problem in the band, actually. I was having too much fun.
Thank you guys for still being around, still making music, still being into it, and doing this podcast. It's fabulous.
Well, I get the feeling that us three should go for a pint. That's what I think.
I'm in a band now. It's called Roxy Music.
You know this thing about the 10,000 hours of experience?
Oh, yeah.
To get good at something. When we recorded Arnold Lane, we'd done about 50 hours.
The Rock on Tours podcast with Gary Kemp and Guy Pratt.
Keep on rocking!
Hey!
Hello, Gary. Good morning.
Hey, Graham. Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you too.
Hello, Graham. I'm Guy. Lovely to meet
you. Hello, Guy. Guy, have we met?
Well, I think we might have said hello at a Sods thing.
Right, okay.
But other than that, but you've always loomed large in my life. I'm a bass player.
Right.
And you've always, since day one, you've been there, mate. So
thank you very much.
Get to talk
thank
to you.
An admirer of your work too, I have to say.
You. Thank you so much.
Oh, right, bass players. Thank
yes,
you.
Yes.
It's great because I've only ever seen Graham really playing guitar because that's kind of most. I mean, when you're out with 10cc now, is it just bass or do you?
I play guitar as well, but mainly bass. Mainly bass.
Now,
but
listen.
I would consider myself a guitarist, really.
I was going to say that because, Graham, this is something that, you know, as a bass player, I find because you are a great bass player. And, you know, you've always been the bass player in the band that you're in.
Yeah.
I know that's not what you do. You're basically a self-contained band in yourself. But the fact you never really talk about the fact you're a bass player. It's like you're almost, it doesn't sort of seem to mean anything to you.
I could talk about it for hours.
Yeah, but isn't McCartney like
that?
McCartney's the same. He doesn't talk like a bass player, does he? He talks like a songwriter and frontman.
And a guitarist, I think. You know, I mean, that's how we all, I think, well, a lot of people I know who play bass started off as guitarists. I got into bass playing because of out of necessity, really, but absolutely love it.
But have you ever written a song on a bass?
I think I have started like with a riff on a bass guitar and gone from there, yeah.
But have you, there's always that thing of even if you're playing the same part as the guitar and the same rhythm, there is something trickier about singing and playing the bass than singing and playing the guitar.
Yeah,
do you find?
Yeah, actually, one of the trickiest things is Things We Do For Love, which is a very sort of syncopated dum dum ga dum ba bum kind of thing. That is, it's definitely like it got me. Took me quite a long time to get used to that.
Patting
but
your
it's
head
natural
and
now.
Rubbing your tummy.
Yeah, no,
yeah,
it
exactly.
Is, it is. I always have to, playing guitar and singing, you could just do it straight off the bat. Playing the bass and rehearsing, playing the bass and singing, you always have to rehearse.
Oh, you've got it so much harder, haven't you?
Oh, you have no idea, Gary. You have no idea.
Graham, before you came on, we were talking about your history pre-10cc, and it's bloody incredible. I mean, it's just the songs that you've written that are seen as some of the greatest rock songs, you know, the absolute sort of bedrock of where classic rock ended up.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It For Your Love and Heartful of Soul, and to a certain extent, Bus Stop as well. You know, It's you were just a kid when you were doing this, weren't you?
Yeah, and it's only in retrospect that I sort of guess I realised the importance of it. You know, it's like when you're in it, you don't realise how big it is in a way, or how important it is. Not like important to the world, but important to yourself. You know, it's only in retrospect that now we're talking about it all these years on that it's still, those songs still resonate. And, you know, I realised I was part of something, sort of part of a music revolution in a way, in what happened with that sort of explosion of what happened with in the 60s, led by the Beatles and us all following behind in a way.
Also, because that notion of, because you were right there at when that kind of notion of what a pop song was changed. And it just seems incredible. Like, into, if you think of what a pop song sounded like in 1964 compared to 67, like, you know, from, say, Bus Stop.
Yeah.
You know,
well, I always think of it in these terms. Like, you'll both understand this as musicians. Up till a certain point in the early 60s, everything was sort of C, A minor, F, G, right?
Which, damn, that's my favourite four.
Well, nothing wrong with it. Absolutely nothing wrong with it.
Well, I wrote my first
song. True's not far off.
It's not far off.
Right, you did use it to good effect. But what happened to me was I heard The House of the Rising Sun, and it was A minor, C, D, F, which to me was like the opposite, the reverse and the flip side, the dark side of C, A minor, F, G, if you like. And I'd always been drawn towards sort of minor keys anyway. And that I use that, particularly the sort of A minor to C, in a lot of, or E minor,
well,
E minor
for
to
your,
G.
Well, For Your Love is the
for
same,
your
isn't
love.
It?
No Milk Today has that change as well. A lot of my songs have those changes.
No Milk Today, which is a lovely pointer towards your lyrical style, the way that you would say you would find a line would stick in your head,
yeah,
which might seem mundane, but becomes, because like you, because No Milk Today is, it is sort of redolent of that whole kind of kitchen sink angry playwright.
Well, it's funny, yeah, but I have to credit my dad. You know, my dad was very helpful to me during the 60s when I was writing songs for the Hollies and the Yardbirds and Herman's Hermits. He was a writer. He wasn't a professional writer, but he was certainly good enough to be a professional writer. He wrote plays, articles for newspapers, and lyric.
What was it? What was his name, Graham?
Hammy Goldman, my dad.
And was he Jewish?
Yeah. Well done.
Sorry.
My dad was very artistic and helped me with the lyrics. And it was actually, No Milk Today came from him.
In fact, you called him Haim the Rhyme, didn't
well,
you?
Well, yes. Actually, Kevin in the band, you know, he called him Haim. Let's call Haim the Rhyme up.
Because that is a very much a trademark of yours, is like is the interesting, unusual, and intelligent rhyme, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's something you clearly love.
Well, I think, you know, I've always been interested in writing about. I mean, I've certainly written, you know, the sort of standard sort of love songs, but I guess that myself and certainly with 10cc, we tried to avoid the cliches, if you like, for a long time. But
well, I'm not in love.
Exactly.
Is the classic.
Exactly. Eric and I talked about. Right. I said we could write the perfect love song, but we don't want to write anything that is a cliche. And I mean, Eric came up with the perfect title, and everything sort of flowed from that. Wonderful. But with No Milk Today, my dad actually. He gave me that title. He said he'd been round to see one of his friends and his friend wasn't in. He turned on the doorstep, saw the empty milk bottle, came back to me and said, I've got a great idea for a song, No Milk Today. I told him that was a rubbish idea. And he said, you're missing the point. It's not about the fact that people don't want milk that day. It's what the empty milk bottle represents. You know, he saw it. He went much deeper into it. The fact that, you know, The bottle stands for lawn, a symbol of the dawn, is such a great line. It's poetry, you know, it's poetry.
Just jump back to the beginning, only because I want to get to something here. It was because your moment was you went to see Cliff Richard when you were 10,
yes,
weren't you, and your dad. And so, in fact, if, with your permission, And Gary, if you don't mind, I'd like to read the first stanza of a poem by Jaime Goldman called Cliff and the Boy.
Yes.
Oh. We all have heroes to worship from afar. My son had one when he was just 10. His name was Cliff, Cliff Richard, the pop star. And when his idol came to town to give a concert at the Free Trade Hall, he played and pestered me for the wherewithal to buy a ticket so that he could see his hero in flesh and blood. Now, I tended to be iconoclastic and preferred the sound of Brighouse and Rastic, but I couldn't deny him this pleasure and joy, remembering that I too was once a boy.
Oh!
Yeah. But we actually...
I won't read it, but the whole... maybe I'll post it somewhere. It goes all the way down and goes all the way through your career. And I'm just going to read the last one, because this is... What a beautiful thing to have from your dad. Writes a hit, into the chart it goes. Watch it climb up and up and up. It reaches the top, as do many more. Then come the prizes, gold and silver discs galore. Was it Cliff who opened the door?
Yeah.
Wow. Well, there's the question. There's the question.
Now. it's beautiful. And when my dad passed away in 1991, I wanted to put together a book of his work. Nothing to do with things that, you know, lyrics he'd written with me. But we actually found that poem. So he never showed me that when he was alive. Aww. But what a find that was. It was beautiful, absolutely beautiful.
Was it Cliff that opened the door?
Well, yes, I guess it was. I mean, there were, prior to that, not exclusively, but like, I'm going to guess that like you, I think I'm a bit older than you, but even so, people like the Everly Brothers, Little Richard, Buddy Holly, Eddie Cochran, Chuck Berry, you know, those were the then the Skiffle era, of course, which isn't talked about so much, with Lonnie Donegan, which really inspired a lot of us. I remember being at school, let's just get anything. Have you got a guitar? Yes. Can you play it? No, never mind. Just let's make some noise together. Then, I mean, Cliff and the Shadows were absolutely massive. I mean, and those records are still great. I'm a mad Shadows fan. And we have the honour to sit with Bruce and Brian as well on occasion, don't we, Gary?
We do. Did you never came down as a kid, I guess, to the Two Eyes Club?
No.
Did you ever? So you saw them up in Manchester?
Yeah. That was the only time. I never,
I'd just like to interject one little thing, Graham, my one little thing here. Yeah. As we were on dad, because my dad co-wrote Rock with the Caveman.
Oh, right, great.
Tommy Steele.
I remember that.
Were you playing by then? Did you have a guitar in your hands? I mean, what was this?
My musical journey briefly was at 7, I became very aware of music. I fell in love with music. I wanted to be a drummer. My mum had a handbag that had like a serrated surface, and I used to use the clothes brushes to sort of go... and I did have some drum lessons, but it was not to be. And although I still love drums, looking at drums and drummers, I was bought a guitar by a cousin of mine, bought me a guitar that didn't cost him a fiver when I was 11. And that, as soon as I held it, I thought, that's it for me. I'm going to be married to this instrument for life. I love
it. What sort of guitar was it? Was it a Spanish guitar?
It was a Spanish guitar with a really high action, hardly playable, and yet it was wonderful.
And the funny thing, and because we all had the Spanish guitar, didn't we? And it's such a fat, flat fingerboard.
Yeah, wide.
When the first time you pick up an electric guitar or something, you're like, oh my God.
Yeah, the joy. This is easy. Yeah.
Were you playing other people's songs then?
Yeah, we were just, I started forming bands when I was about 14 and just playing covers, just doing whatever was in, I can't even remember what they were, but whatever was in the charts.
Do you remember that first song that you wrote?
I do. I think about it with a little bit of horror, but it was so naive, but then that's what one would expect. You know, I think I started writing sort of when I was about 17, 18. Really simple stuff, but then when I was 19, I wrote the first song that became a hit.
Why did you start writing? Was it because you didn't really like the covers you were playing, or was heard that?
I was really inspired,
anyway?
Like me and millions of other people, inspired by the Beatles. Yeah, right. Suddenly, it was we don't have to go down to Denmark Street and go around all the publishers to find a song. I was in a band at the time with Kevin Godley called The Mockingbirds, and we did mainly covers. No one would give us a song, so a combination of necessity and inspired by the Beatles, I started writing seriously.
And how was it? And how did you meet Kevin, by the way? Were you at school?
Kevin, Lol Cream and I all used to rehearse at a place called the Jewish Lads Brigade, which was like a social club in North Manchester. And, you know, they arranged sports, social events, did lots of things. It was a really buzzing, fantastic place. And
did you have punch-ups with the Salford Lads Club? I only know that because it's been immortalised on that Smiths album.
Oh, right, that's right. The Salford Lads Club was a long way away from where we were. But the deal was that the club allowed us to rehearse. They had lots of different rooms there in exchange for us playing at their social events. That was an excellent deal, I must say. So that's where I met Kevin and Lol.
And was there an immediate rapport with them? Were they already a songwriting team, or did they have any?
No, they were just playing in bands. I think when I first met them, they were in separate bands. But I was in a band called The Whirlwinds, and we were doing a lot of cabaret circuit in a way, and doing lots of covers and kind of old fashioned songs. A few, you know, we had a manager who was. Used to go to Italy a lot, so we used to do a lot of Italian covers, like Romantica, I can't remember the titles of them all, but I actually got fed up with it all and decided to form another band, and I'd heard Kevin playing in this other band and thought he was very, very good, and said, listen, I'm going to form another band, do you want to join with me? And that was the Mockingbirds, which actually contained half of 10cc.
Did you get signed? You got signed by Giorgio Gromowski?
We did get signed, and everything we recorded, whether it was a cover or a song that I'd written, did absolutely nothing.
Was it Gromowski?
But every song that I gave to other people was a hit.
Amazing. Did you have to go to London for that to happen, or were there sort of business people?
I think we had business
Manchester.
People that came up. I don't remember going down to London all the time to make that all happen. I mean, we did record in London. We recorded at Advision. Do you remember Advision Studio?
Yeah.
We did some recording there with Giorgio Gromowski, who I'd already had a relationship with because of the Yardbirds, and he did a record with us. Yeah, and then Kevin and Lol had a project called Frabjoy and Runcible Spoon that came out on the immediate label, I think it was, which was something that Giorgio was associated with.
So Runcible Spoon, because Runcible is Edward Lear, isn't it? That's an Edward Lear word, isn't it?
This was just some sort of mad
but
name.
But already there's a sense of humour in the band, isn't there? A sense of,
of
irony.
Yes, and so Kevin and Lol and I were kind of friends. We were from the same area. And now we've got 3/4 of 10cc.
7.5.
Yeah, if you like.
Yeah. So let's just mentioning Giorgio Gromowski, because he was famous. Was he at the Railway Tavern? Wasn't that guy? Have I got that all wrong?
That was where the Yardbirds managed, played there, didn't they?
Yeah, he managed the Yardbirds.
Yeah, he managed the Yardbirds.
What club did he look after? A club as well, didn't he?
Wasn't he to do with Il Piano? Was it? No, wasn't Richmond Hotel was the Stones. There was Il Piano.
I remember Klook's Creek.
The Ricky Tick Club.
Yeah.
I'm sure our listeners will know.
This is all the stuff. I mean, this used to be like my history lesson. I read it in so many books, you know, and Long John Baldry, Cyril Davis.
I saw all those.
Alexis Corner.
I remember whenever I used to come to London, I went to the clubs and was just blown away. But I actually saw the Yardbirds came up to Manchester a couple of times.
How did you get the song to them?
Okay.
Yeah,
well, my manager at the time, Harvey had this.
So you had a manager?
I had a manager, yeah. Harvey was very important in my starting off my career. He managed Herman's Hermits, and he lived around the corner from me. He'd heard I was writing songs, I don't know from whom, and he came round, and I was working in an outfitter's shop at the time. I'd started writing songs. eventually got the sack because I was playing with the Mockingbirds quite regularly. So I was coming into work late or leaving early to go and do a gig. Got the sack. Harvey started paying me like a retainer just to, you know, like a small wage. He said, why don't you just write songs all day? I thought, okay, I can do that. My parents were horrified at first, but had always been very supportive of me. And like within 6 months, the Yardbirds had recorded For Your Love. So it worked out quite well.
That's amazing.
Quite well.
So did you do the demo and then?
Okay, yes, I did the demo. And what happened was Harvey was a big thinker, okay? And a lot of the ideas were absolutely ridiculous, but some of them were very good. And he said, I'd written For Your Love, he said, I think we should get it to the Beatles. I said, I think the Beatles are okay, the songwriting department. Now, although it was a stupid idea, it did lead to the publisher saying, that ain't going to happen. But by coincidence, the Yardbirds are supporting the Beatles at the Hammersmith Odeon at a Christmas show. And they're looking for to kind of go commercial in a way. You know, they decided they wanted to stop being just a pure rhythm and blues band and do something that might get them some chart success. I mean, they were wonderful.
But it is extraordinary that if anyone who knows the Yardbirds historically basically knows them through your songs. And the funny thing is wouldn't actually know them as an R&B outfit at
no,
all.
No, possibly not. But I had the honour of seeing them both with Clapton and with Jeff Beck. Anyway, the song got to the Yardbirds and Paul Samuel Smith, who was the bass player and producer and really the musical sort of looked after everything musically for them. He said, I think this is great. And they recorded it. And then.
Have you got that first demo still?
Yes. Yeah.
Have you ever released it?
What would you have recorded it on?
We would have recorded it. This was when we started Strawberry Studios. It would have been done at like a demo studio. I think somewhere in South Manchester we did it. And the bongos are on it, but there's no harpsichord. I thought that was a touch of genius, using the harpsichord. But I did play an acoustic guitar on the original demo.
So when you say there's no harpsichord, no bongo, but is there a band?
Yeah, there's a band arrangement. Yeah, there are bongos on it.
Oh, right. Okay.
Yeah, there are bongos on it, yeah.
Oh, right.
But they, first of all, putting the harpsichord on it changed it dramatically, obviously the sound sonically. And there were various other changes from the demo. So they did. There was a lot of some songs that I've written. The artist's record are very much like the demos, and some of them are not. And the Yardbirds, in particular, did change things a lot.
But I heard Brian Auger turned up to play the piano, and there was no piano there. There was just a harpsichord. And he thought it was ridiculous, but he put the harpsichord on. Because it sounds like it's one of the first records, actually 60s records, to have the classic harpsichord.
Yeah, I mean, in stories like that, there was no piano, so I played the harpsichord. You know, it's like, how does this magic, isn't it? You couldn't have gone, if someone had said, oh, I think this would be a good idea to have a harpsichord on here, no one would have thought of that.
But it then became a 60s thing, didn't it? I mean, there was that TV show,
It was a very Ted Astley thing. Like that you have a harpsichord, a very fuzzy guitar, and maybe a bit of flute. But it had the thing of where basically it sort of goes into this middle eight where it basically turns into another song. Where did that idea come from?
Oh, the middle section, yeah. It was just a thing that I thought was a good idea. You know, I'm certainly not the first person to do it. But I like the idea of why shouldn't it suddenly change and like into a whole different thing? But of course, there has to be some sort of connection between the two parts, even though they're very, very different from one another.
Yeah. The legend has it, though, that it was that song that made Clapton leave, because he didn't want to become commercial.
I don't think it was. I think it was the last straw, basically. I think he was not happy with he wasn't happy with them changing direction. He was a real blues purist at that time, and they were going for what he considered a pop song, which I've never thought of For Your Love as a purely pop at all. I think it lives in its own world.
Yeah, well, and it's a sort of proto rock song. It's like bridging that gap.
It's up there with.
I was going to say that it's a proto rock song.
It's up there with my. It's up there with my generation as being. Classic.
Right. Yeah, thank you.
But you had the privilege then, of course, of your next song having Jeff Beck on it.
Yeah, I mean, really, the greatest. God rest his soul. What a player! And you know, they originally had because it has a very sort of Indian feel to it, that opening riff, and they had a sitar player in, but you must have worked with a lot of classical musicians. A lot of them don't understand the sort of like 1 2 3 4 1, you know, they're just, I don't know what it is, but this sitar player couldn't get the feel of it at all, and Jeff said, I can do that, of course.
Did he? So he played it.
But it does seem quite a funny thing to do, to get in any player of a stringed instrument in that band, which is all about guitar.
Yeah, I know. Chords. Yeah, it was a brave move. But
so dump the harpsichord. Let's get a sitar. You know.
Yeah, that's right. there you go. They were quite experimental with their production wise, I have to say.
Oh, and didn't you have a funny thing on top of the
box? Yes. With the Yardbird.
With the Mockingbird.
So, yeah.
Well, in fact, two birds. And you were in another bird.
Yeah,
band,
the Mockingbirds. Right? Yeah. Well, what is it with the birds? I don't know. The Mockingbirds were sometimes were invited to the Top of the Pop studio, which was in Manchester originally. And it was a converted church in Dickinson Road in Manchester. I remember that for some reason. Anyway, but one time we were on, I think we did it two or three times.
You
one
were the warm-up act, right? You were
like the warm-up, yeah. So they had to set up the lights and cameras and everything else. So to keep the sort of invited audience entertained, we'd play a few songs. And on one of these occasions, the Yardbirds were actually on and doing For Your Love, which was great. And so people have said, didn't you feel weird or wasn't it odd? You said, like, you should have been doing it. Said no, I was absolutely not blown away. It was brilliant.
Did you go and introduce yourself?
Did you do it in your warm-up set?
Did you yourself, Graham?
I don't remember. You know, it's a very vague period. I did sort of meet them and talk to them only on one occasion. I remember meeting them in a pub in London. But I was a very, very shy boy, and I don't know, I just felt really weird. You know, they were like, wow. You know, it was the Yardbirds, for God's sake.
Yeah, but you think they'd want to come up to you and go, God, man, you thank you for my career.
I can't actually remember that happening. Other artists who have recorded my songs, but I don't remember that. But I have no problem with that. I was just honoured to. I mean, I was a massive fan of the Yardbirds anyway. So to have them record one of my songs, or actually three they did, or eventually.
By I guess eventually they started writing themselves, like Shape of Things, was that?
Yeah, you know, Shape of Things, yeah.
I learned from you.
Well, even that, because that has that thing of two different, very different sections.
Yeah,
different
they did. They were, I think they were inspired by that. I mean, I'd obviously heard it somewhere else. I mean, we're always, I don't want to say, I like to use the term, I was inspired by rather than I stole that idea.
Yeah, of course. And how did your relationship with the Hollies come about? Because you wrote Bus Stop for them.
The Hollies were managed by, they were actually in Stockport, sort of south, their manager. I think that's where they were based. So their manager, a guy called Michael Cohen, had a shop called the Toggery. And the Hollies used to go in there.
That's so sexy.
Yeah, yeah, the Toggery. It's great, isn't it? And they'd heard, do you know, I've heard different stories and I can't remember. The Hollies had already recorded Look Through Any Window, which they got via our publisher. And then I think it was Tony Hicks and Graham Nash came around my flat to listen to some songs. And I don't remember actually taking anything. I've taken one song, a song called Schoolgirl, which they did record. It was never released. But the main thing that happened to me was that the Mockingbirds were supporting Hollies at Stoke Town Hall, and they said, "Have you got any other songs?" I said, "Yeah, I've written one specially for you." And they said, "Well, let's hear it." So we went into what I remember is like the smallest, quietest place backstage, which was because there was a lot of noise for some reason, which was in the loo. And I played the bus stop and said, that's great. Can you make a demo of it and send it to us?" Which I did. And that was a major thing for the Hollies, because Graham Nash has always said that song changed his life. Wow. Because it was a hit in America.
Wow. So there would be no Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young or any of those if it hadn't been for you taking them in the toilet to play them bus stop.
I took him in the toilet.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
So you saw yourself pretty much then, I would have thought, as a songwriter for sale.
Yeah.
That's what you
were
going
to be. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I was very happy to be a songwriter. People said to me, "Oh, doesn't it, you know, irk you, like with the Yardbirds at Top of the Pops, that other people are recording your songs, you could have had a hit with them yourself." Well, I thought, there's no guarantee of that. You know, I mean, I was massive fans of the Hollies and Herman's Hermits and the Hollies, the Yardbirds, I mean, and I was very happy for them to be recording the songs.
And you're a bass player by this point, though, aren't you?
Well, I've been a bass player, yeah, for a long time, because I had a Revox tape recorder and I was, bouncing tracks and making demos, and I wanted to have a bass on it. So I thought, well, I could do that.
That's the extent of your bass playing career. That's great. That's
that's how it started.
I need to bounce something on my Revox.
But I'd already...
Great. Thanks a lot.
I'd already taking notice of, like, James Jameson, McCartney, you know, all the other great bass players, and was kind of loved how important the bass is, as you and I know. So I was kind of a bit intrigued by it, you know.
Guy texted me yesterday and he said, "Art for art's sake, man, that bass on the intro is incredible."
Yeah, well, actually, that's not me.
No, hang on, was it Art for Art's Sake?
Yes, it was Art for Art's Sake. It's actually Eric playing... I've got a Fender six string bass, and Eric played it because we wanted more of a kind of a lead line thing.
Oh, and it's a six string. That's why it's
funny you say that, because it reminds me of the way David Gilmour plays bass. That's quite funny.
All right, okay.
David's actually a very, very good bass player. But so what? And because you've always played a Rickenbacker, haven't you?
Well, the first bass I had was a Precision. But I fell in love with the Rickenbacker mainly through McCartney when he...
That was my next question, because of McCartney?
So
yeah.
That started me on with the Rickenbacker, but I never actually got on with Precisions, but I loved jazz bass. So on stage, I use the jazz bass with round wound strings and the Rickenbacker with flat wounds.
So, Graham,
That's the correct answer.
Is it right answer? Yeah. Thank you.
So, Graham, you go off to America, don't you, to sort of get involved in a songwriting... Sort of project.
An interesting thing. This is sort of, I'd already become a partner in Strawberry Studios, which was started off by Eric Stewart and Peter Tattersall. Then I went to America to work with some people called Kasnets and Cats, who were famous for bubblegum music, like yummy, 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 I've got love in my tummy.
Yeah, Ohio Players.
Ohio Express.
Ohio Express.
Very, very strange them asking me. And I think the reason was they wanted to change their output and make it more sort of British, more mainstream pop. I don't know what their motivation was. It wasn't, artistically, it wasn't the greatest period of my life, but it did have a very important upside in that I was working.
Well, you're in New York.
I was in New York. Well, it wasn't that. I got actually was yeah. there for, I can't remember how long I was there for, but I got fed up there and said, I'm part of a studio in the UK working with some other musicians. What I want to do is take these songs and I'm going to do, we'll make the records in Stockport, it was. And that was working with Eric and Kevin and Lol on those records. So this is pre-10cc. So although there were many other things that brought us together, that certainly was something that definitely brought us together in that we were in the studio making music together.
This is long before, you were basically the first kind of gang of guys who had a studio back in this time. And I think this feeds so much into why 10cc were the band they were. No one had that facility.
No, there's no doubt about it. Without the studio, there's lots of reasons why we wouldn't have existed. But one of the main ones was that without the studio, we wouldn't have existed. It was our playground. And boy, did we play.
But, you know, it's interesting because you say that you were doing Bubblegum with, you know, the Mindbenders, Ohio Express. Actually, you sang on one of those songs. Actually, I did find a funny picture because they got a band, because there was no such band as Ohio Players, was there? And Express, I mean, sorry.
Yeah.
And they had to get a band in. They got this band in, I think they were American, called Timothy and the Royals, which are totally Austin Powers. When you look at
right.
The picture.
Yeah. Yeah. So everything was like a lot of things that we know now. It was not the people that you see performing on the TV. It was session musicians in the studio. And then, you know, someone like the Monkees, in a way, yeah. A kind of a manufactured band that, although nothing wrong with the Monkees, I have to say, but, you know, well, we were led to, the public was led to believe that they were playing on the records.
You know, what's interesting is that you say it's, you were doing Bubblegum, but in a way that's kind of what happens on the first 10cc album, is it? Because Donna and Rubber Bullets, you know, had a 50s pastiche feel.
Yeah, we love pastiche, I have to say. You know, it was, I think the main thing was, looking back, it brought us together as to what became 10cc, and it was also good business for the studio. It kept the, you know, it was important.
Because how was this? Do you all had shares in the studio, or, you know?
No, it was just myself, so you're like, myself, right. Peter, and Eric, who were the studio owners. We did eventually, our agents, Kennedy Street Enterprises, who were the agents of 10cc, right. Got involved as well as the studio expanded.
So is this, is Hot Legs already happened? The sort of, you know, when the
Hot Legs
around.
Happened while I was in America working with Kasnet's Cats. They had actually were experimenting with a new four track that we had in the studio, and Dick Leahy, who was I think with Phonogram, or I can't remember what label he was with, happened to be in the studio. And it's one of those stories where he's talking to somebody in the studio and he can hear this Neanderthal man playing, and he's going, "What's that? It's a smash." That's when A&R man said, "I've just heard something. It's a smash." And anyway, he was right. Yeah. And that became, yes, so Hot Legs had a big hit with Neanderthal Man. They were offered a tour with the Moody Blues and asked me to join to play with them. And that and from then on, we just stuck together.
It was the separation between the songwriting teams. That was obvious right from the beginning, was it?
Not really. I mean, a lot of the songs are myself and Eric and the other team being Kevin and Lol. But there are a lot of songs where we've, you know, Eric writes with Lol, I've written with Kevin, I've written with Lol, I've written with Kevin and Lol. So it was mixed up. But if you look at the big hits, you'll see the sort of two separate teams.
Well, it's, yeah, there was, I mean, it's, because you and Eric are the kind of very much the songwriters that, and the sort of more arch comedic stuff comes from the other two. But what I think is the great crossover is is that rhyming thing of yours, which is, I think, it was so important, especially on the kind of more lull.
Yeah.
And Kevin sort of humorous. But
the lyrics were always clever. Clever lyrics.
Yeah. No, the lyrics were always brilliant.
I think the Kevin and Lol had written a lot of most of Rubber Bullets, but wanted a bridge, you know, a bridge. Because it means that it's got to be 8 bars long. It's got to be 8 bars long.
Bridge 2.
It could be a middle 10 or something.
No, except, well, just, yeah, middle. It's just, I know, it's, I hate the American use of the word bridge.
We all understand what it means.
Yeah.
Anyway, but so I wrote this middle part to the song, and then, but I did come up with a very good part of a verse that says, we've all got balls and brains, but some's got balls and chains, which is in part Rubber Bullets.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, what were the influences? I mean, was it Zappa?
There was Zappa. There was
Steely Dan. Was that Steely?
There was Steely Dan. There were different influences. I mean, for myself, the common influence was the Beatles. No doubt about that. Mm. But for myself, it was people like Burt Bacharach and Hal David, Jim Webb, Paul Simon. You know, like the sort of songwriting greats, really.
Because you've always had that very interesting chord thing, which I think later on, which Andrew Gold is the perfect match for that. It's almost like, which is people like Todd Rundgren, I would say. And you are very, and your use of chords is absolutely fantastic. But yeah, so also, I was going to say, a song like, were you involved in the lyrics of Wall Street Shuffle?
Yeah.
Well, that was your song.
That's so arch and so funny.
Yeah, it's funny. It's funny how it's still used, because it's still sort of relevant, you know, to... today, whenever there's some sort of financial crisis, that, you know, they always seem to play it quite often. Anyway.
There was a feeling, it looks, as an observer, when you get to Sheep Music, which is your first sort of really successful album,
that
you and Eric had the singles and Graham and Lowell had the album tracks. Was there a friction appearing in that?
No, you know, we had a very... for a long period, had a very healthy relationship with each other artistically, in that whoever wrote the song, we would never reject a song. It was like, if you wrote it, if you think it's good enough, fine, we'll do it. However, I reserved the right to say, listen, I think, can we just change, can you repeat that section again? It's like a waste. I remember saying that to Kevin Lowell so many times. That part is so brilliant. You've got to repeat it somewhere down the line. So we would help rearranging the song. We might suggest a different chord or something, or, you know, but all the production ideas came from the four of us. Basically, we'd adopt the song as our own, whoever wrote it.
And the lovely thing is, of course, you can do all this in the studio, actually just making the record as you go, which is
without being charged, because you own the studio.
Yeah, that's right. So we had that freedom. There was no pressure like, oh, come on, boys, the next session's in, you've got to get out. I mean, we'd often work in the evenings when no one else was coming in. That was great.
Yeah, because that's the point. Because was it very much a working studio? Was there a lot of outside stuff coming in?
Yeah. I mean, famously, while we were recording Sheep Music, McCartney was in with Mike McGeer, his brother, recording an album in the evening, and we were recording during the day. So the control, the studio was absolutely crammed with gear. You could hardly move in there.
And McGeer's.
McGeer. And Paul was around a lot. And, you know, I think I can feel him inside, although he didn't plan anything, the fact that he was around so much, I think that influenced what we were doing.
Wasn't he playing drums on that album? Was his drum kit set up?
Drum kit there, but we actually used that drum kit on Wall Street Shuffle. Had a very loose snare.
Was it Paul's?
That was the days of that sound. We used his Mellotron. We nicked
it. Oh, my God.
Well, we didn't nick anything.
Not the Mellotron that's on Sergeant
Pepper's. He shipped it all the way up to Stockport.
Well, because Mike McGeer lived in Liverpool. They'd just come in from Liverpool every day, so it wasn't that far.
So was Lily the Pink recorded there?
And it wasn't. No.
Oh.
But there were a lot of you have to look at the history of Strawberry Studios to see who recorded that. Particularly a lot of the sort of like people like Joy Division, the Smiths.
Yeah, I said it was seminal. So, it basically made that whole post-punk thing possible. Yeah. I mean, incredibly important in Britain's cultural history.
And I actually attended an event in Stockport on last Friday, which Stockport is the town of culture at the moment. And in their museum, they had an exhibit on Strawberry Studios. And the amount of people that have recorded there was, I mean, I was even surprised that I didn't know half of them who had recorded there. So the studio became really important for musicians in the north of England.
Did you?
I mean, basically, we set the studio up because we didn't want to have to come down to London all the time. Simple as that.
Did you put the desk
in? But we wanted a proper studio, and it was.
Did you put the desk in and all the equipment? Is it all your...
Yeah, we put the... Yeah, we've had a few desks in there.
I love that. Don't you, Guy? That line from 10cc and, you know, art rock through to Joy Division, still doing art rock, you know?
Yeah.
And beyond, the Smiths, I would imagine.
The Buzzcocks.
The Buzzcocks recorded there, yeah.
I mean, none more important than the Buzzcocks, really, than... Because they were the linchpin. It was the Sex Pistols going to Manchester.
When did you let it go, Graham, the studio?
What happened was that Kevin, Lol and Eric decided to move to the home counties. And I didn't want to leave Manchester.
Good on you.
We thought, well, let's open another studio, which became Strawberry South, which although was ultimately a financial disaster, did produce the Deceptive Benz album and the Bloody Taurus album, which had Good Morning Judge, The Things We Do For Love, and famously Dreadnought Holiday. But what happened was that Kevin and Lyle left the band. Immediately we sort of started to build the studio in Dorking. They just had had enough, but Eric and I, after much debate, decided to carry on under the name 10cc.
Yeah, yeah.
And then come up with a massive hit straight away. That was lucky.
I just want to ask you about art rock, because, you know, that's how, you know, you look the genre that 10cc are seen in. And was it something you were conscious of, that there was only so much art you can have, that you might lose commerciality, and how you played that game of, you know, a song like I'm Mandy Fly Me or Art for Art's Sake. You couldn't risk that nowadays. You couldn't put a song
You couldn't
like
do
that.
It nowadays, but actually the joy of 10cc was we didn't write for you, we wrote for me. Mm. It was for us, it was for our own pleasure, and we never ever took notice of any trends or anything like that. And we were lucky enough that what we produce people liked enough to buy records of
and got played on the radio.
And how was it, because you stayed in touch, I know, certainly with Kevin all the time. I mean, with things didn't get personally bad, had they? Or
Kevin and Lol left. I was very upset. I'm still upset, right, actually, that they left, because Kevin and I have talked about this. You know, we've remained very good, very close. How we could have handled the whole thing better. Maybe Kevin and I should have taken a year out or whatever, and we could have reconvened. But there was a pressure from the record companies to produce another album, which meant another tour, more rehearsal. There were two reasons really why they left. One, they got fed up with this sort of constant cycle. It was repetitive, and I think they got bored by it. And the other thing was that they invented this attachment for the guitar called the Gizmo.
The Gizmo.
And they were they made an album which ended up as being a triple album. And it was just taking forever to finish. And we needed to get on with recording 10cc. And it was like, you've got to make a choice, guys. And they said that we've had it. But Eric and I carried it on to great success.
We've jumped ahead slightly, because I do, you know, we can't have you on without talking about I'm Not In Love, honestly. You know,
okay.
you must be driven mad by it. But, as
you are mad.
Well,
certain songs. You've got to do it though, haven't you?
Yeah, but I mean, obviously, you and Eric sit down and write this song. But who comes up with the idea of the production? Because the production really was so unique.
it was really Kevin and Lowell between them, I think. I think it was Kevin said, why don't we do it with voice, just with voices? Oh, what a great idea. How are we going to do that? We don't know yet, but we'll figure it out. So the idea was that we put a backing track down, do it with voices, and then because we needed something to sing to, and then take the backing track off, and we'd be left with all the voices. So we did the backing track, which was done very quickly, which was Eric playing Fender Rhodes, me playing rhythm.
Well, that's a particularly lovely Rhodes sound. Yeah. It's one of my favourite Rhodes sounds.
Yeah, we used we had these orange sort of phaser boxes.
Yeah.
It was in stereo, so each channel out of the Fender Rhodes in stereo went to a separate track. So that's the beautiful sound. Perfect, obviously, for the record. I played a rhythm guitar on an electric guitar, and Kevin played a Moog, a Polymoog synthesizer on a kind of bass drum sound. And that was the track, which was going to be, the idea was to take that off, as I say, later on. But even when we'd done that, there was something, we could tell there was some sort of magic in the air. And then we started putting on the voices, which required us to sing each note, multi-track it, make a loop of it, and spin it back into the multi-track. So without going into too much detail, so that on the, I think it was done on 16 track, we'd have like 11 tracks of lots of us singing.
16 track? You're only on a 16 track?
I think we were on 16 track.
And of course, and did you literally loop the tape so it was going around and around?
Yes.
So we, like a mellotron.
So we made a tape loop of the one of each of the 11 or 12 notes or however many we use and spun them back into the multi-track so that eventually, so we had the backing track and then we had all these notes. But we needed to mix all those notes down to a stereo pair.
Mm. But then you have to play the desk like a keyboard.
Exactly.
Don't you?
So right, four of us were on the desk playing, using the faders as bringing up these different notes at different times. It was a joy to make because, of course, now today, if you wanted to do that, you just get a sampler and bang, you got it in immediately.
Yeah.
What was brilliant about this was we listened to it grow with each note. Mm. And there was this beautiful, with all of them playing, this wonderful clash of voices that was so amazing. And in fact, throughout the track, it never actually disappears. It's really, really low in the track. There's this constant sound. You can't hear it, but it's there. But obviously, you hear it when they're playing. You hear it when they play, when the faders are up, but then they never actually disappear. And when we finished the recording, we knew we had something great. Didn't realise its commercial potential at all, but knew we used to turn the lights off in the control room and lie on the floor and listen to it back, like a few times. We thought it was brilliant.
Totally life-changing. And if anything, you were the absolute inheritors of what the Beatles had tried to achieve or was beginning to discover in studios. Yes. From Sgt. Pepper's. This was everything that they'd given you in a way, wasn't it?
Correct. Absolutely. Yes, correct. Whereas normally you would rehearse a song in a rehearsal room, go into the band and record what you had already rehearsed, whereas this way we're starting from scratch, really. We had the song, of course, but the production ideas were just came and grew while we were in the studio. There was no preconception other than the voices, but of course that changed because you obviously still have the backing track on the record that you know.
Because the way the studio was built, wasn't it? It was the first one where the studio, the actual control room was big enough for you to all be in.
No,
or was that the next one? No,
no, okay. There was a control room and we did a lot of recording in the control room.
Yeah,
you know, I would always try and put the bass on as late as possible, because I always felt like the bass kind of got absorbed into the track as everything else was being recorded. And then you would might have to re-EQ it. Whereas if I put the bass on nearer to the end, it's a better sound.
Do you know what? Funny thing is, Graham, because, you know, being an 80s boy, most of the sessions I used to do were towards the end of the recording, me in the control room with the producer, not out there with the drummer. You're absolutely right, because, you know.
How did you ever worry about translating that into the live onto stage? You know, how could you...
It never inhibited us. We never said, well, we better not do that because we'll never reproduce it live. So, no, that didn't worry us.
And how did you
and
do
also,
something
now,
like
now
that?
We have, yeah, but how, yeah. we have ways.
Yes, but then, in those
days... But back then, yes, exactly. Gary's making a very good point.
How did you do it in those days? How did you get out and play those songs?
Well, the only thing that we've ever... we'd compromise.
Yeah.
We'd have to compromise and prioritise what we could do. I mean, if we like got four acoustic guitars playing, well, there'd only be one. Or not.
But I mean, I'm not in love. You could have used a Mellotron. You could have actually.
Well, we could have done, but actually, that was the one track where we thought we didn't like the principle of using backing tracks live, but because there was no other way of doing it, we did.
Yeah, well, it was pretty much frowned upon, wasn't it?
Yeah, I still frown upon it, but that's an exceptional circumstance. I think anybody would.
That's Kevin.
All right, Kevin again. anybody would forgive us. For doing that, because we want the listener, you know, the audience's experience
I'm not in love stands up as a song. Take all that away and just use
correct.
You know, you play that on a piano or on a guitar. It's an amazing song.
Well, I do an acoustic show called Heartful of Songs, which is myself and three other musicians, where I do an acoustic version myself. And obviously there's no backing tracks or anything like that. But as you say, the song stands up on its own. And I don't know whether you found this, Gary, but, you know, if you've got a good song, that kind of the production ideas, it inspires great production ideas. And I'm Not In Love was one of those songs. And one thing I should say about it, the record that you know is the second recording of it.
Oh.
We did a previous recording of it in a kind of a bossa nova rhythm, almost like a Burt Bacharach type, and it didn't work at all. And unfortunately, like everything else that we didn't like, that we did, we erased it.
Yes, yes.
Oh.
We didn't want anybody to get hold of it. That would have been a nice thing to have had.
I remember being in a studio with Trevor Horn, and when he didn't want somebody, just say, burn it.
Burn it. Yeah, I like that.
Because he didn't have, because he hated options. You know, he wanted,
And then you've got you don't have to worry about it anymore because it's gone.
We've just, Guy and I were in Australia in the autumn with Nick, and we bumped into Rick Fenn.
I know you did. Because I was recently on tour with Rick. We came back last, a week today from a 3-week European tour. Yes, and Rick told me about that.
Yeah, lovely guy.
Australia clearly suits him. He looks amazing.
No, he looks great. And he moved out there like over 20 years ago.
But I mentioned it because...
But he comes out, God bless him, he comes over here. For him, it's a commute, you know, to come over here to play with the band. And he's fantastic. The thing is, we always do the same thing. He comes in the day before we're going to start. We go out for a curry that night. He falls asleep in the curry, and then I sort of bring him home. He stayed with us. And then the next morning he gets up and off we go.
But I mention him because obviously he joined the band when you became really a two-piece, didn't you?
After Kevin and Lol left. So we'd had Things to Do for Love was a hit, and we decided to go on the road. So Rick and Paul Burgess, who made the Deceptive Bends with me and Eric, we decided to go on the road, and Rick was in that band. And he's one of my oldest musical companions and friends. So I've known him since 1976.
Did the band feel very different? Because apart from, I mean, there are songs like Anonymous Alcoholic.
Yes.
Still have the sort of very arch kind of thing. But it was, would you say you became more of a conventional band?
I think it changed. And it we lost 50% of the band. You know, it wasn't like well, we've lost someone who plays the drums only and someone who plays keyboards only. Kevin and Lol were...
Glad you didn't say bass.
...were fellow songwriters, producers, singers, players, you know. So it was a big loss. That's why, you know, it was debated whether we should have the right to retain the name. But anyway, we obviously did. And but it did change. Yes, it felt different. But we were very determined to prove ourselves that we could still produce, you know, the goods.
Well, was Dread?
Well, you were straight out of the blocks with Dreadlock. With
The Things We Do for Love.
Dreadlock Holiday.
Yes, the thing, Things We Do for Love was the first. I think Good Morning Judge, which was a sort of minor hit, but Things We Do for Love was a big hit.
And Dreadlock Holiday was as well, wasn't it?
Dreadlock Holiday.
Number one. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, one thing that's interesting about 10cc, we had three number ones with three different singers.
Yes. Yes.
Lol sang, Lol sang Rubber Bullets. Eric sang I'm Not In Love, and I sang Dreadlock Holiday.
And ironically, Kevin has an amazing voice. And
well, you took the words out of my mouth. Ironically, to my mind, Kevin has the best voice.
Yeah.
Wonderful voice. Yeah.
I'm going to make one really, really annoying, pissy little bass player point.
Oh, if you must.
Because
the playing, no, because I love because your bass playing can be so Iceberg, by the way.
Yeah.
Special mention for Iceberg. Wow. Really, really lovely. But on Dreadlock Holiday, what's interesting is how, because the line is great and suits the song properly, but it's interesting you didn't lean towards any sort of reggae sound on the bass.
No.
Still with a pick and quite clipped. And
yeah,
quite
well, tricky. I always play with, I occasionally, if it's something slow, I play with my fingers, but really I'm a pick guy. And so, yes, I know, you're right.
You didn't think to dial the bass up a bit, you know?
I don't know, we didn't, it just didn't feel, I'm sure we would have done that because of the, you know, how heavy and sub bass the basses are on real reggae records. But if we ever remix it, I'll see what I can do there again.
Thank you, Greg.
And how was it?
We'll do the Pratt mix.
How was it with Andrew Gold? Because you formed this band called Wax, didn't you?
Yeah, I loved Andrew. We met Andrew because our American record company wanted us to work with an American writer-producer. Andrew was suggested. I absolutely jumped at it because I was a big fan of his anyway. And he fitted right in with...
You could see exactly why.
Yeah, it fitted right in.
I must say, I love your writing together.
Yeah, well, we did an album, as far as 10cc is concerned, we did an album called 10 Out of 10. There were three singles from that album, none of which, I have to say, were successful, but those three singles were co-written and co-produced with Andrew, so that sort of proves it was a good call. And it was especially good for me because... Not long after that album, Eric and I kind of fell out, and I couldn't take it anymore. And the first person I called was Andrew and said, I've got a studio at my house, little studio, nothing fancy, but do you want to come over? This was after he'd gone back to America. Come over and stay with me for a couple of weeks and let's have some fun, you know. And he stayed for about 6 months, actually.
Wow.
And that really brought us together. We did an album in my house that's never been released, but has some fantastic stuff on it, I think. We put one single out called, what was it called? I can't even remember the name. Anyway, I've got a senior moment there. However, we did go on to record an album with Phil Thornalley produced.
And
produced I know Phil very well. In fact, I've worked with him recently on a new solo album.
He co-wrote Torn, didn't he?
He did, and produced it. So Andrew and I did this album, which produced a track called Right Between the Eyes, which was a big hit in Europe, not in England so much, and went on to have a very, very happy, both musical and personal relationship. I loved Andrew.
Yeah, well, you wrote a very sweet song dedicated to him, didn't you?
Yes, Daylight.
When he passed.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They're playing with Ringo. We have to talk about that. I mean, that must be a fanboy moment for you, isn't it?
A real fanboy. Surreal. And I wrote a song about it on my... I put out an album in 2020 called, the album's called Modesty Forbids. Don't mind me getting a plug in there.
Absolutely.
And the opening track on it is called Standing Next to Me, which is about my time with Ringo and the band. And it was amazing. Wow. I got a call from his tour producer, who asked this daft question, do you want to join Ringo Starr on the All-Star Band?
Yeah, no.
He said, yes, please.
Oh, who wouldn't?
And it was a great experience working with Ringo. He was charming. He was funny. Does not suffer fools easily. And quite a fantastic person, I must say.
He's got very so kind. Much youthful energy. I can't believe it. I mean, you see him now on social media.
He's a fitness fanatic. He always go to the gym, watched his diet. You know, he's very, very strong and sort of wiry. He's all muscle.
And when you're playing in front, because he's so distinctive as a drummer, when you're playing in front of him, you could hear Ringo. I don't think there is a drummer that is so complimentary to the songwriter.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, occasionally you'll hear those fills that only he can do. And it's like, wow, this is amazing, you know. I always wanted to be in the Beatles. Well, I was never going to be in the Beatles, but I came close to it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's true. But no, it's true, because just last point on that is there are things like Come Together. He should actually have published.
Oh, absolutely. Who would have? Amazing. And when he was very free, you know, he'd answer questions, you know, nerdy questions he'd answer. And things like Here Comes the Sun, you know, his drum part on that. Did you work it out? Did you do this? He said, no, I just did it. You know, we think it's so complicated and so, because maybe we, you know, we can't conceive it being that easy. But like anything, you know, what's easy to you is impossible to somebody else.
He's never thinking, I'm just going to lay down the right groove for this. He's thinking, what is this song trying to express and how does it move? And he's listening to the melody all the time, isn't he?
Yeah, he just knows. And instinctively, he leaves the right spaces and fills in the right fills.
One thing I want to touch on, Graham, for you, is that, of course, you wrote two songs and on her fantastic last album with the amazing Kirsty MacColl.
Yeah, I did.
Because I used to work with, I adore Kirsty.
Oh, yeah.
A friend. I used to work with her a lot.
What a loss.
I'd love to know your experience of working with her.
Well, I loved her. I actually met her at a writer's week that used to be organised.
A Chris Difford thing?
Yeah. It was before that.
It wasn't that one.
They were organised by EMI Music Publishing, who we were both published by at the time. Mm-hmm. And they used to have these weeks where they would take like maybe between 12 and 15 songwriters to this sort of country house. I think it was called Hunsham Court.
Hunsham Court, yes. In fact, Gary, you came and saw, I did a couple of those.
Okay,
with Chris,
okay, right. I was partnered with Kirsty one day with somebody else, and actually not a lot happened. The third person wasn't, nothing wrong with that, the way that person wrote, but there was something, you know, a lot of songwriting partnerships are to do with chemistry. You know, you can get the two great writers together and nothing happens. But with Kirsty, it didn't happen, but we sensed that there was something that we could do together maybe later on, and which we did. And I wrote two songs with her. One was called Treachery, which is on the Tropical Rainstorm album, her last album that she made.
Tropical Brainstorm.
Yeah, Tropical Brainstorm. And the other song was called Things Happen, which was a B-side of a single. The songwriting day, I used to go around to her. She lived not far from me in Ealing. And there'd be a lot of chat and drinking coffee and listening to sort of samba and South American music going on in the background. And then we'd sit down and write.
Amazing.
And it was wonderful.
Yeah.
Wonderful.
You doing another album, Graham?
Yeah, I'm in the middle of, well, actually, I've nearly finished it. I sort of get the urge to do one every sort of 3 or 4 years. So I've nearly finished one now. It's what I call my very expensive hobby, but I love doing it. I love writing. Some of the songs are just on my own, and I've written with other people. And I just absolutely adore the whole thing of writing, recording. It's just wonderful. So I'm very happy.
And is it with Phil Fornelli you're working?
Well, Phyllis and I have, we wrote one song, which was very, very Beatly. And I said to Phil when we were in the middle of it, I said, I think I know someone who might play the drums on this very Beatly track. And he did.
Oh, amazing. Graham, it's been great having you on. Thank you so much.
Great to speak to you, Gary and Guy. I've really enjoyed it.
Really, really lovely. Really lovely to talk. And like I said, you've always loomed large. It's really nice to finally talk to you, Graham.
Thank you so much.
You know, it's a fantastic story, isn't it? Of this young kid with his supportive father and you know, giving him song titles and being obsessed with, you know, the Beatles, and then, you know, having all these huge hits and ending up playing with a Beatle.
Now, that is amazing. I know. Yeah, you were getting very fanboy there, weren't you? At the Ringo thing. You're jealous.
Of course I am.
No, but what's so nice was the way he was talking about doing his albums now is that he's still got that same boyish enthusiasm that he had when he was literally a boy.
Yeah. And accepting that maybe they're not all going to be hits, but I still have to do this, is the thing.
I wanted to make a point, because when he said he calls it his very expensive hobby, and I would argue it might be cheaper than sailing. I'd also say to our listeners, by the way, that first stanza that I read, if you just Google Jaime Guldman, it was like a very early entry. You can find there's that whole poem, which is called Cliff and the Boy. And it really is a lovely thing. Well, I mean, and the fact that he didn't know about it till after his dad had died is what a gift, you know, from your dad.
Yeah, absolutely beautiful. So. Thank you to Ian for producing today for Gimme Sugar. And yeah, that was, I really enjoyed that. I'll be seeing you soon, I would imagine.
Yes, although you didn't ask me if I'd be performing. Was I presume that's some sort
of
thing. It's
the Songwriters of Society of Distinguished Songwriters. Yes, it's our Christmas get-together, and people have to get up. Some people can't sing a note, but they've written some of the biggest songs in the world. Don Black always hosts it. It's very nice.
Yes, you used to invite me.
Oh, God. So needy.
There was a year I did that thing.
Oh, listen, I've got to get out of here. It's good night for me.
And it's good night from them.
Rock On Tours is produced by Gimme Sugar Productions for Warner Music Group UK.
When you make decisions for your company, you look for the no-brainers. If you have a lot of mailing to do, Stamps.com is the ultimate no-brainer. Use the Stamps.com mobile app to mail everything you need to keep your business running with up to 89% off USPS and UPS. Make the same no-brainer decision as over 1 million other businesses with Stamps.com. Use code PROGRAM for a special offer. That's Stamps.com, code PROGRAM.